Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Rihanna.
What does Florida Man and hurricanes, what do those two things have in common?
Florida Man, it really like describes the headline to an article. Like Florida Man does this. Florida Man gets on his boat in the middle of a hurricane with his shotgun and his American flag. He just doesn't care in the face of danger, in the face of an alligator.
He laughs in the face of adversity.
Exactly.
He is defiant. He is proud. He is strong. He is Florida Man.
I think there's a little bit of Florida Man in all of us.
Oh, definitely. I'm totally Florida woman.
Especially when it comes to hurricanes. I think a lot of us aren't overly concerned about hurricanes. You know, hurricane season comes around every year, and most Floridians, they do prepare ahead of hurricane season. At least that's what they said when they were surveyed by AAA back in April. Over 70% said they make advanced preparations, like ahead of time, like before June, July, which...
Okay, but how do they define preparation?
That's because... my question. I've been to the grocery store during hurricane season. I don't know if I believe that 70% of people are ready. They're ready for a hurricane.
There are two types of hurricane preparedness. There are people who prepare like at the beginning of the season. There are people who kind of wait to see what the season is doing. And if it's been like especially active, they're like, okay, maybe I need to like go get some stuff. But then there are the people who prepare before the season, and then they rush to the grocery store when they already have stuff at home ready to go. And then they buy it all up so that then the late people come in and they're like, there's nothing here.
It's just that habit. Or you see other people going to the store and you're like, well, what if I need something? I have to get it before they
do. Yeah, it's like the flock is flocking. I need to flock too.
A majority of those respondents to that AAA survey said if they were warned to evacuate, they would evacuate. That was about like 70%. Mostly, they want to stay in case there's damage to their property that they can fix. When I was a kid, I think it was Hurricane Wilma in like the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. We had a trampoline in the backyard.
I'm sorry, I'm not laughing.
My mom was one of those people who stayed in case they could fix something, which meant going and trying to grab the trampoline as it was going over the fence in the middle of the storm.
Oh, no.
That's what people think, though. That's what they mean by if I stay, I can fix this. But there's also financial restraints and pets and just not knowing where to go. But the second most cited reason for not evacuating, what do you think?
They don't believe the storm is going to be that bad.
They believe the storm will turn away from their direction. They don't believe it'll be that bad.
Yeah. They're like, nah, it's not going to happen. I mean, I understand because we've been tricked by the cone of uncertainty before.
Yes.
Like there's only so many, oh my God, you're inside of the cone of uncertainties that can go. And people are like doing all of this prep and they're getting emotionally invested and they're waiting around and they're nervous and they're anxious. And then nothing happens. And then they're disappointed because they're like, but I've spent all this money, I've done all this prep, and y'all told me that the storm was coming and nothing happened. And over time, if that happens enough times, it becomes like the boy who cried wolf. But as we've come to find, the cone of uncertainty might be a little bit misleading.
This week, we're talking about the way we talk about hurricanes. Weather tiger Ryan Truchelet is a weather forecaster. You've likely read his forecasts in the Tallahassee Democrat during storm season. And if you happen to be in the cross section of weather nerds and dad joke enjoyers, you might even be subscribed to his newsletter.
The one that was the worst for me personally was Charlie. Hurricane Charlie happened on August 13th, Friday the 13th, 2004. I was definitely telling my friends and family, hey, look out, a slight shift in the angle could make this a much worse storm for Orlando. Just in the last 6 to 8 hours before landfall, it deviated just a 20 or 30 degrees north-northeast. And that made a huge difference in terms of where Charlie made landfall. Rather than there being 24 hours until it became landfall in Tampa, there was 12 hours until it came in the Fort Myers region. The eye of Charlie went right over my house. When more storms started developing in that very busy 2004 hurricane season, people started calling and emailing me when I was up at college, and I started putting my thoughts together into an email and sending that out to friends and family, and it was kind of forwarded and spread, and that's how Weather Tiger's Hurricane Watch newsletter got started back in 2004.
It's a lot of responsibility being a forecaster, or really anyone put in the position of trying to get Floridians to prepare a go bag instead of buying more White Claws for their hurricane party. A lot of people in my life put weather forecasting in the same bucket as astrology. There's just not a lot of trust there, and you need that trust when people are really in danger.
I guess it's just important to remember that the Hurricane Center forecasters are human beings, they're fallible. You know, we're not going to have perfect forecasts, especially for intensity. Rapid intensification is a tough thing to forecast, and that can really, you know, amplify those risks in a way that, you know, can happen in a short period of time. But we have come so far. I mean, a 5-day forecast in the 2020s is as good as a 36 or 48 hour forecast was in the 1980s. You know, I think it's just important to remember that hurricane forecasting is a huge success story in terms of applied science. The better our forecasts are, the fewer people we have to warn, the fewer people who have to react. People don't want to hear bad news. As a meteorologist, I don't like to or want to scare people. I want people to be enjoying their normal lives as long as they possibly can, and warning as few people as, you know, as I possibly can. I don't want to be giving false warnings out to more people than I need to.
I mean, I feel guilty when I'm doing the weather and I notice that I keep telling people it's going to rain and it doesn't. And I'm not a meteorologist, y'all, so please don't shoot the news anchor.
You don't want to overshoot the risk, and you also don't want to undersell it.
Exactly. Because then you run the risk of, well, what happens when it actually comes and people really are in danger? And like, as a journalist, it's part of my decision making every single day. There's always that question of, well, what if we're wrong? If you don't say anything and then you get hit and people had no idea it was coming.
Yeah, there are people's lives in your hands. Potentially.
I still remember we were here at, I can't even remember what o'clock hour. It was Hurricane Michael, which hit Panama City. And we were working overnight here at the station because we had to be prepared. And I remember watching that storm escalate in its intensity at an hour when most people were asleep. And I remember the sense of fear and dread that I had, wondering who is listening, who is watching right now, as every major local and state agency basically sent out, please get out now if you can. And that storm was as bad, if not worse, than anything I think we could have imagined for ourselves. And having a sense of feeling powerless, because at that point we couldn't leave here because the wind was howling, the rain was blowing, the doors of our studios were, I was worried that the outside windows were going to blow out at any moment. And that was here in Tallahassee. So you can imagine what it looked like and what it felt like over in Panama City. And as a journalist in the wee hours of morning, as I am trying to convey in my voice a sense of calm inside, I was terrified, and I felt terrified for everybody in that area, only thinking about, oh my God, what's going to happen to the people who stayed? And our morning edition host, her sister and her husband were one of those people who stayed. They are fine. They are fine. But I think when we interviewed them the day after, they said that if they could have evacuated it, or when they heard the evacuation notices, that they wish they would have evacuated.
Communicating that risk, it is a huge responsibility, and you're kind of fighting uphill against people's presuppositions about hurricanes, or their almost their confirmation bias, because every time they didn't prepare for a hurricane in the past, it never hit them. I think for most people, they assess the level of danger they're in based on the category of the storm. Most of those respondents in that AAA survey said they wouldn't evacuate for anything less than a Category 3 or 4.
Have they been in a Category 3 and 4?
See, the problem is the category of a storm, it doesn't describe the level of badness, which I think is most people's interpretation.
I don't think people truly understand what wind speeds either.
No.
Because when we're talking about category, we're only talking about the wind speeds. We're not talking about all the stuff that's flying and turned into projectiles and missiles in that wind, nor are we talking about things like storm surge, water inundation, flooding.
Hurricanes, they're not just wind events. I honestly don't even know if people know the categories refer to wind speed. I would love that to be surveyed. Because when I ask people,
what do they think the categories mean then?
Badness, level of badness. 1, not so bad. 5, real bad.
I think that maybe we need to do better about not focusing on the category. When Hurricane Katrina made landfall, the maximum sustained winds had dropped to Category 3 intensity. So officially, Hurricane Katrina is a Category 3 hurricane at landfall. Well, that doesn't really describe the surge impacts, because Katrina had been a Category 5 for 2 days leading up to landfall, weakened at the very end in a way, again, that's almost kind of misleading, because it weakened, its maximum sustained winds went down, but the wind radii continued to broaden to landfall. So, you know, if someone heard, oh, well, Katrina dropped from a 5 to a 3, it's not as big of a threat anymore. That's simply not the case, because surge is the most deadly hazard in a landfalling hurricane.
Rather than category numbers, Ryan focuses on impacts-based forecasting, taking into account rainfall, storm surge, the movement speed of the storm over land, the size of the storm. Some of these storms are like 100 miles across, and that makes the eyewall much bigger. These are all factors that, when combined, can really explain what you can expect to experience on the ground.
Rather than focusing on a number, you can kind of break that down into what are those specific 4 impacts going to be in terms of storm surge, wind, flooding, rainfall, and tornadoes. A hurricane that's moving very quickly is going to spread destructive winds well inland. But a hurricane that's moving slowly, you're going to have higher rainfall totals in a more localized area. So, I mean, this is the flip side of the coin. We're talking about Hurricane Katrina. The primary hazard there was surge. The storm that's tied with Katrina for the most expensive United States hurricane of all time is Harvey. Now, Harvey was a Category 4 when it made landfall. And of course, it did wind and surge damage as well. But the damage that was done in the Houston metropolitan area. And it was a flood event. Rainfall, it's just not something that I think people really think of as a first order hurricane hazard. And it really should be, because in the past 10 years, that's been what has caused most of the casualties in the U.S. from landfalling hurricanes.
On this week's extended episode, we continue our conversation about the way we talk about hurricanes. Hurricane communication is always evolving, and recently, the National Hurricane Center released its new experimental cone of uncertainty graphic. If you were to look at that graphic before, you'd see 2 things. You'd see the track of the cone, and you'd see these red and blue highlights going up and down the coast. Red for hurricane winds, blue for tropical storm winds. Now, instead of just showing those wind warnings along the coast, those colors extend inland to better indicate the impacts inside and outside the dead center of the storm. Of course, I had to talk to Ryan about the proverbial cone of uncertainty, what it's useful for, what it's not useful for. So here's Ryan.
I think there is a misconception out there that the cone represents something about hazards or impacts, and it doesn't. It's not an impacts cone. It's a representation of where the center of the storm may track, indexed to the average amount of error over the last 5 years of hurricane center forecasts. So that cone is going to contain the path of the storm about 2/3 of the time. And that's kind of the threshold that they've decided to where they're going to draw the line. Now, a couple things. One, that means 1/3 of forecasts are going to fall outside the cone. That's a pretty substantial number of cases. It's not unusual for a hurricane to track outside the cone by definition. You know, but two, that cone contains some possibilities for where the center is most likely to go. Now, you can, of course, have impacts well away from the center, hundreds of miles away from the center. You know, extreme rainfall is, you know, something that happens hundreds of miles away from the center. Surge is something that happens along the track. I'm hoping that something better than the cone is eventually developed. You know, when it came out 20 years ago, the forecast errors were much broader. You know, the cone for Ivan extended from, you know, Texas to Miami. So yeah, you may actually be covering more or all of the areas that could see an impact. That is the area that might possibly have something bad happen. But we've gotten better. So the cone has gotten narrower. The cone's gotten smaller. But of course, the area of impacts hasn't gotten any smaller from hurricanes.
Wind speed definitely does matter here.
Yeah.
Because of our tree canopy. And as we saw with tornadoes, wind and trees do not go hand in hand. Yeah, they're not friends. Mm-mm.
Yeah. And according to Ryan, we could have a low category hurricane and still experience immense damage, like we saw with those tornadoes, which weren't 150 miles per hour.
I mean, Hurricane Hermine, which hit us, was a category one. And I remember there was a picture taken from one of the roofs on top of Florida State University. Someone took a photo that showed the entire city black, like darkness. And that was a category one.
All you'd have to do is, you know, go out to Blountstown or Mariana and, you know, we can see what that looks like. I mean, you can see what wind gusts of 120, 130 miles an hour would do. You know, there's a big, big difference between getting 60 or 70 mile an hour or 80 mile an hour wind gusts like we got in Tallahassee during Michael. You know, that can do a ton of tree damage. If you lose the game of pine tree roulette and a pine tree comes down on your house, you know, that's obviously going to cause a huge problem for you. But you can see from those areas in Tallahassee where with the tornadoes, we had EF2 level damage, so 110 miles an hour or greater. You know, you're starting to get into the range where you don't need a tree to fall on your house to get structural damage. You're starting to see, you know, roof damage just from the wind itself. It's certainly, you know, we love our trees here, and they're, you know, urban trees are very nice for keeping, it keeps temperatures down. It's a nice amenity to have, but it's certainly something that if we saw widespread 100 mile per hour plus winds would definitely lengthen the recovery time.
It doesn't mean that you have to be terrified all the time.
No, go out and enjoy the beach. Just not before a hurricane. Please don't do that.
I think understanding hurricanes beyond the category number and the graphic on the television screen, understanding that the cone of uncertainty doesn't describe the size of the storm, understanding all of these things will help you prepare smart. Right. And I think you don't have to be ashamed of over-preparing. I think that's a big thing for a lot of people is just, well, I don't want to overreact.
Oh, yeah, because then we're going to laugh at you.
It's true, because people are like, oh, are you not native to Florida?
Of course not. That's why I'm the only one out here preparing.
It's true. It is a level of pride and a level of, like, cultural norm that, like, yeah, if you're preparing for this little storm, you must not be really Floridian.
For the past couple of years, I have actively been thinking about buying a generator for my house. I'm going to commit to the generator. I'm doing it.
Good.
Thank you. I'll let you know when I buy it. It's going to happen this season. It's happening. I promise. It's happening. I'm going to do it. I am making a promise on air that Lynn Hatter is going to buy the generator.
You've got like a month to do that. When does hurricane season
December. End? December. Oh my God. We just had this whole show.
I don't know. I didn't learn that part. I didn't ask that question.
We're keeping that in the show.
Thanks for listening to Speaking Of, the Unbothered Edition from WFSU Public Media. New episodes drop every Thursday, and you can find them wherever you get your podcasts. Speaking Of is produced with support from PRX and is made possible in part by a grant from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation.